This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
Today, I want to make an introduction. Introduction of somebody you know well. I mean, not like personally in the flesh, but somebody whose life you know something about. Somebody, no doubt, whose words you know something about. We're in the book of Acts, and late in chapter 7, in the book of Acts, we get the first mention of a name of somebody who will become the dominant figure in the second half of the whole book. This guy's life, his journey is going to take over the whole narrative. But you don't know him yet. In fact, if you didn't already know the story, you wouldn't suspect him yet. He's an unlikely candidate to be that person that I just mentioned, based on the little bit that you receive right up front when you first are introduced. But we're going to do it. We're going to look at the first introduction of somebody who's going to be the most important figure in the book later, the second half of it. And really, I don't think I'm overstating it to say somebody who's going to be one of the most important people in world history. I really don't think that's an overstatement. I'll say more about why. But we're introduced to him for the first time a couple of places. The end of chapter 7, he's just a, quote, young man. Which itself is interesting because I bet most of you in here, when you picture Paul, when you imagine Paul, you picture old man Paul. Old, seasoned traveler, missionary, apostle, writer Paul. You picture the old guy. But here in chapter 7, the first brief mention is, quote, a young man named Saul. You know, everybody who's old was young. Unless you're Benjamin Button. Everybody who is old, who was young. See, the youngsters can't believe that. They look around at some of us and they're like, no, you weren't young. Oh yeah, old man Paul was young man Saul back in the day. And that's how we see him in the beginning. He's guarding the cloaks. He's standing guard over the garments of the witnesses and participants who are involved in the mob execution of Stephen for his so-called blasphemy. And this is somebody that, as I say, I mean, most of the people in this room, I mean, you say, oh yeah, I know this guy well. I mean, some characters in the Bible I may be a little fuzzy on. I mean, you know, some of those obscure kings in some of those places, I couldn't tell you about them very much. But Paul, I know this guy. Now, you've been reading Acts along the way with us. I mean, you're already way ahead. You've already followed the story quite a bit. And you've all quoted him. We've all quoted him. In fact, you know, almost everybody's quoted him. People who are not Christians have quoted Paul lots of times. Because some of their favorite quotes might be from Paul. They may not even know it. But they'll say, oh, this wonderful, one of my favorite lines. That I've, you know, his words are embroidered on things, you know. They make sort of good verses on cards. There are a lot of people's favorite verse, life verse. They're sort of like decoratively put on things. Some of your favorite words in the Bible, and even people outside who don't know the Bible anymore, so we'll still quote him. I mean, his words have lasted. So really, we say, well, we already know him. We don't need to talk about him. But do we really know him? Do we understand where he came from? You get to know somebody better when you know where they came from, don't you? You kind of understand where they came from. You get to know them a little better. Now, where did this guy, this important figure, come from? I mean, who really was he? And in introducing Saul of Tarsus and in talking about him, the point isn't to necessarily glorify and make everything about this man, but when you look at his life and everything about his life, you can't help but be impressed with not just him, but God. The glory goes to God because you will see providence in the preparation of this guy for the life that he's been going to be called to. If you didn't know the end of the story, like I said, it would be different. So there's not a lot to look at here, but I do want to show you where he's introduced, a couple of places. So let's look at Acts chapter 7, verse 58. It's really brief. Sometimes I give you a lot of words and sometimes I don't. Here it is, the first brief reference in the context of this stoning narrative of Stephen. He says, then they cast him, that's Stephen, out of the city and stoned him. And the witnesses, laid down their garments at the feet of a young man named Saul. And then a little bit later, you get to the very first verse of the 8th chapter, and it says, sort of finishing off that narrative, it says, "And Saul approved of his execution." That's all you get in the beginning until the end of chapter. And chapter 9, we'll start talking more about him. Chapter 9 begins with the words, "But Saul." This tells you about how he's continuing to ravage the church and persecute. And then you get his conversion story, which we'll get to that on a different day. Right now the question is, well, who really is the young man Saul? Pretend you never read Acts before. Pretend you didn't read Romans, Philippians, Galatians, Colossians, Ephesians, Thessalonians. Pretend you didn't read any of that stuff. And you didn't know who this is. And you're just going along in the story for the first time. And in the here's this new name. And this young man, Saul, approved of his execution. And next thing you know, he's on a tear against the church. Who is he? So I want to say a little bit about who he is today and show you in the background of Saul the perfect preparation and the providential oversight of God to manage the affairs of history to make a guy everything he needs that guy to be. For a huge mission and a huge purpose that he has. So I'm going to show you how Saul, he's Greek, he's Roman, and he's Jewish. No, I'm not really trying to contradict myself, but in different senses, in different ways, he's all of those. He's kind of got all the important bases covered. These are the three major influences of the world. If you're going to reach the first century world, you're going to reach a world that's Jewish, at least at the outset, where the beginning of it is, the God of the Jews. But in the bigger sense, it's going to be you're going to reach a Greek world. It's been Hellenized. It's all the cultural. You don't understand Greek culture, language. And you're going to reach a Roman world legally, because the powers that be, that's who runs the world, the Romans. Saul is all three of them. We're going to look at all three of these things. He's all of them. He's born in a Greek place, in a province that's all Greek, in a centuries-old city that's thoroughly Greek. Like about 85% of Jews at the time, he's scattered. He's born outside the homeland. He's Roman because he's a citizen. He's legally Roman. The first Jewish, or for that matter, Christian person in the book of Acts that we can tell who is. All right, this is something that very few people could say that. Roman citizens, we'll say more about that. And obviously, he's as Jewish as you get. An Israelite, circumcised on the eighth day from the tribe of Benjamin, as he says. He's named, his parents named him after the most famous member of their tribe of Benjamin. And Israel's first king. That's who he's named after. He is Saul. So I want to explore each one of these more and see the providential hand of God at work in the preparation of the man who would change history. But he had to be changed first, didn't he? But who is he? What's in the background? You think God wastes the background of people? You think he wastes the upbringing and experiences and knowledge people gain and all that stuff, where they come from? It's just inconsequential? I think it's not inconsequential, not just for a great person who does a great thing like Paul, who's known to history, but I mean, for you. For you, your background, where you came from, who taught you, where did you grow up, what did that give you, what did you learn from that, what skills did you get from that, what experience did you get from that? And that's all part of the picture, part of the plan. See, we have the benefit with the life of this guy to see it from first to last. You know what I mean? We can see the whole picture because we know where it starts and where he ends. So it's easy to see it now, but it's harder to see it when it's happening in real time, isn't it? It's the same with all books and novels and movies. You know, once you see it all, you're like, oh, I get it now. I see how that was working out now. But at the time, may not have yet. Like that unfolded. And so, right now, in the storyline, you just have this young guy, Saul, in the book of Acts. You don't necessarily know this, but he was these three things. So let's talk about then the Greek part of this young man, how Greek he is in his culture and influence. He comes from a place called Tarsus, Saul of Tarsus. Now let me show you where Tarsus is, as if it matters. Now, if you pull out your phone and GPS it, in case you wanted to find out how to get there, I don't know what the lady's voice would tell you. You know? Plug in Tarsus and see what she says. You know? Please. You got to exit the parking lot. You know. Make your way. I don't know. What does she say about stuff like that? Get you to an airport or something? Go rent a boat. I don't know. But this is Tarsus. In what today on a map would look like Turkey and Syria. But it's the old Asia. The old, what they call Asia Minor. Notice all of those names. Oh, those sound familiar from the New Testament. Well, there in the province called Cilicia, underlined in red, is Tarsus. That's his hometown. What kind of place is Tarsus? Tarsus is the capital of that province. So it's a capital city. It was on the coast. You sort of see it's very near the coast. So it's an important port city. So it's really significant for trade. And this was a big deal back then. It's really significant for trade because it's an important port. And it's got this river that runs right down out of the mountains through it. And that was an important passageway. You know, so they controlled that passageway. This Cydnus River came down. It's an ancient city, really old. It goes back a couple of thousand years, maybe more. People have been living in it. Archaeological records say that the Assyrian king Sennacherib once captured this city and restored it around 700 BC. I mean, it's older than that. But you know, you might remember the Assyrian king Sennacherib from your Old Testament, the feared ruler, the tyrant who attacked Judah. But then he was defeated when God intervened on behalf of the king Hezekiah and delivered him into his hand. That's Sennacherib once captured it. So this river comes down out of those mountains. The Cydnus River flows into the Mediterranean there. It's a cold river, you know, like got that snow runoff. And so when Alexander the Great conquered this city, he swam in that river. It was a really attractive river. He wanted to go swimming. And then he caught a cold that almost killed him. And that's what happens when you jump in a cold river. Now you fast forward a lot of years after the death of Julius Caesar, when the generals were fighting over the future of the empire, Mark Antony took a liking to the city. He favored it. And so, when he met with the Egyptian queen, Cleopatra, for the first time, they formed an alliance in the year 41 BC. Guess where they met? Right there in Tarsus. The Egyptian envoy came sailing down the Cydnus River. So it's a city with a lot of history in it. Tarsus was a city of great learning. So the university in Tarsus was considered among the best. The head of the University of Tarsus was a personal friend and advisor to the Emperor Augustus. I mean, that's a big shot right there. That's rubbing some shoulders. Tarsus was known for the Stoic school of philosophy. You ever hear about the Stoics? Some of you are kind of Stoic in your own way. Which may not mean that you subscribe to the philosophy of the Stoics. It just means you got one of those personalities that, you know, you don't give yourself to too much emotion either way. Just kind of keep it balanced. Right? The Stoics were about more than just that attribute, but it was related. So they had some famous Stoics. Just before Saul was born, had been these famous Stoics that head the school, a Zeno of Tarsus, named after the founder of Stoicism, and then Antipater of Tarsus. I know you've read all their works. Of course. Antipater of Tarsus. Yeah, I got all of his stuff. Why not? But just prior to Saul's time, these guys had really thrived. So you don't think the young Saul knew something about the leading Greek philosophies like Stoicism. So he later, some of what he would write would let you know that he did know about these things. The first century historian and geographer Strabo said this about the city. He says, quote, "Among the men of Tarsus, the zeal for philosophy and other kinds of education surpasses that even in Athens and Alexandria and any other place renowned for schools and occupation in philosophy." Now, if we wonder if young Saul picked up on this, well, just remember now, years down the road, Paul the missionary would go right on into Athens itself, didn't he? He went right into Athens. In Acts chapter 17, and to those Athenian philosophers all sitting around, he quoted to them one of the poets. Remember? He quotes to them one of the poets. And he doesn't say him by name, but he quotes Aratus of Soli. And that poet that Paul quotes to them happens to be himself from the province of Cilicia. So Sully was another city in the province. So Paul kind of quoted one of his local Greek poets, you know, that he knew well. So he's able to do these things, to draw on this sometimes. And when he writes to Titus, he quotes this famous line when he says, "Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, and lazy gluttons." Not a very nice thing to say about those Cretans. Of course, these days, if someone calls somebody a Cretan, that's not a compliment. You know, poor Cretans. But it was a proverb. This came from Epimenides, who, incidentally, himself was a Cretan. So he's kind of like joking about his own self and his own people. But Paul quotes the line. See, he knows these things. He's educated. He understands Greek learning. Can that help a man who is then called and sent out across the world, from city to city to city, where in every city he goes, the culture is largely Greek? Yeah, it might help you a little bit. Could Peter have done that? I mean, I don't know. Peter might have had a rough go of it trying to roll through Ephesus, you know, trying to go on into Corinth and mix it up. Might have been tough for the Jewish fishermen who never went out to those places before. But Saul was ready for it. Tarsus was also a city of industry. They got a lot. They had a lot of stuff going on. They made a lot of money because they did textiles. You know what textiles are? Making all kinds of cloths and fabrics. They were known for this goat's hair felt. You know, I wouldn't mind wearing a nice goat's hair felt shirt. If you find one at a garage sale, you go ahead and, you know, get me one. Goat's hair. So it was known for all these textiles producing this, and that would include clothing, but guess what? It would also include tent cloth. Tent cloth. You see, young Saul learned himself a trade. Did that come in handy later in his life? So as he's out there on the road, far away from anything, on long journeys, visiting various cities, the guy's got to eat. Saul had a skill. He could make some money. Tent maker. So, growing up in Tarsus, had a few privileges. And you know, he was proud enough of having grown up there. In Acts 21, there's all this tumult going on. His crowds are against him. And so, he asks the Roman Tribune, Paul does, let me talk to the crowd. And the Roman Tribune mistakes him for somebody else. He says, "Hey, wait a minute. Aren't you that Egyptian fella came through here not long ago causing all this trouble?" He gets him wrong. It's a mistaken identity. And what Paul tells him, he says, no, I'm not that guy. He says, "I'm a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no insignificant city." I mean, I don't know. He's almost bragging a little bit about it. Hey, there's nothing wrong with being proud of where you came from. The mean streets of Tarsus. You know, so he owns it. And when he calls it no insignificant city, that's not just, you know, like boastful talk. I mean, really was a significant place. So here's what Bible scholar William Barclay said about Tarsus. He said, "It was a city so cosmopolitan that none could walk the streets without coming into contact with the ends of the earth. It was a city with such a history that none could live in it without some sense of its greatness. It was a city with such a desire for knowledge and such a respect for scholarship and such an intellectual ferment of thought that no thinking young man could entirely escape the contagion of the thronging ideas which crowded the air. If a man was destined to be a missionary to the world at large, there was no better place in all the East for him to grow to manhood than in Tarsus." So the divine hand moves the levers of things to prepare somebody for something big. Well, young Saul then, no, he's as Greek as you can be culturally. He knows all that. But he's also got something else that's important going for him, legally speaking. This young Saul is a Roman citizen. When you say, well, of course he was. I mean, like, he lived in Rome, right? Well, yeah, but the whole known world at the time, practically, everybody they we would have known as far as you could see lived under Rome. I mean, Rome was a massive empire dominating. But not everybody was a citizen. See, that's why he has that other name. Some people say, some people assume that, oh yeah, see, he was Saul, but then because he got converted. And you know how sometimes the stories back in the Hebrew scriptures, you know, God would give a new name to somebody. That's not what's going on here, though. He got that name at birth because every Roman citizen was given their Roman name. Whatever your ethnic name was, that's fine. But when you were listed on the rolls of citizenry, you had your Roman name, your cognomen, they called it. So when he was listed in the census as a citizen, he was known as Paulus, is what it would have said. Not that Jewish name. And so when you see his name in the book of Acts begin to be Paul instead of Saul, it's an indicator of where he went. It's an indicator that he's not among the Jews anymore. Because, I mean, naturally, when you go out around the world, when you go out among those people, you begin to use your official name as a Roman citizen. So he has the two names from birth. Citizenship was really important. How did you get it? I mentioned that Tarsus had favored status because Antony had a special liking for it. And if you lived in some places, you're more likely to have it. He didn't just get it himself. He was born with it. His father had it somehow or another. And if you ever got citizenship, you passed it on to your kids. So it was inherited from that point on. And more of the residents of Tarsus sort of had the good fortune to gain citizenship than in other places. Citizenship was a high privilege. You had to earn it, or if you were wealthy enough, buy it. They say that throughout the empire's 60 to 70 million some odd people at this time, stretching across all of their part of the entire planet, nearly half of the empire, maybe as many as half, would have been slaves. And a lot of the non-slaves were still not citizens. And it depended on where you lived. So, for example, if you lived in Italy, some 70% of the people of Italy would have been Roman citizens. But when you went to the provinces of North Africa and parts of Asia, it might be less than 5% were citizens. You could gain your citizenship by military service. You could have served your time out as a slave and got your freedom. And as a freedman, then you could get citizenship. I said if you're rich enough, you could buy it. You might have served the empire in some way. Citizenship has its privileges, doesn't it? It has its rights. You know, we still value it. We've recently been celebrating the fact that after a long process, Joseph and Mavis celebrated the fact that she has her citizenship now coming her way. She will be a full citizen. But, you know, it's a process. You got to jump through all these hoops and do all these things. But for the Romans, I mean, it was bigger than even that. You just couldn't count on those rights and privileges. Things we all pretty well take for granted. I mean, if you were a citizen, you would get a guaranteed a right to a fair trial. If you were a citizen, you couldn't be tortured. If you were a citizen, you couldn't receive the death penalty unless by conviction of treason. Like you had to actually be guilty of that and they had to show it. If you were a citizen and you even did receive a death penalty, it had to be a humane execution. Does that stuff matter? Imagine I said all the people in that throughout the empire who weren't citizens. What does that mean for them by implication? It means they didn't necessarily get a fair trial. And they could be tortured. And they could get death penalties for who knows what. And they could receive death by terrible, terrible means of execution. Do you think it's a fluke that when Peter was executed at the end of his life in Rome, and when Paul was executed at the end of his life in Rome, that they received very different executions? What did they do to Paul? He lost his head. What did they do to Peter? According to tradition, crucifixion. Well, that's not very nice. Paul had citizenship. They were not allowed to do him that way.
You might go, yeah, well, hey, a lot of good that does when they decapitate you.
Listen, that was considered nice. That was considered the kind way to dispatch of you. You know? And if you had enough money, you pay the executioner to sharpen up his blade real good. Make sure it's a clean cut. I'm sorry to be grim about it. But I'm just telling you, these are the realities. And so, that's the difference. So, did it matter? Look, at one point, you see here, you remember this account, don't you? He's about to just be flogged. They're just going to put a beating on him just because. And he's like, oh, whoa, hey, wait a minute. Time out. You do know I'm a citizen, right? You see, you can't do that to a citizen. And when he made his appeal to Rome, you think if the Apostle John had said to any average governor, I appeal to the emperor, I appeal to have my case heard in Rome, they'd have said, yeah, right, okay, thanks for sharing. Some fisherman, who are you? You don't. But a citizen has the right to appeal. It's kind of like a citizen can say, I appeal to the Supreme Court. And so, he goes to Rome. He's under house arrest. He was treated that way. So was it important that he had this benefit of citizenship? Could he have been the missionary he was? Could he have accomplished what he accomplished? Could he have made it that far and run the race that long and that far and gotten where he did without citizenship? I don't know. I'm not sure it could have happened. Greek and Roman, but let's just get right down to it. When you get right down to the heart of this man, he's Jewish. He's a true Israelite all the way, isn't he? According to Philippians 3:5, he says, I'm a Hebrew of the Hebrews. I mean, this guy's totally, fully, thoroughly Jewish. And he gives his bona fides to them, because some people said, this guy, he's not a real Jew anyway. That's what you do sometimes to people who don't totally agree with you. You say, well, you're not a true one of us, you know. You're not a real one. You're not a real American. Right? We do that kind of stuff. If someone disagrees with you enough about things, you just revoke what they're supposed to be. So Paul, because of his boldness with the gospel, some fellow Jews looked at him and said, you're not a real Jew. To which he responded, oh, really? I'm circumcised on the eighth day. I know my tribe. And I'm not just any Jew. I'm a Hebrew. In the parlance of these times, to call yourself a Hebrew in this context, in this day and age, was to say more than I just got Jewish blood. It was to say, I have fluency in the old language of the scriptures. Like, I'm not just any Jew. I am trained. I'm a scholar in this stuff. And was he? Yes, he was. Fully, thoroughly Jewish. He learned the scriptures as a boy. He was trained probably around the age of 12, according to custom. They sent him to study under a great rabbi, and not just any rabbi. Saul went to Jerusalem and was taught by Gamaliel. And Gamaliel was the grandson of the great rabbi Hillel, who began one of the leading schools, rabbinical schools. And Gamaliel at the time was the current president of the Sanhedrin and the most respected of all Pharisees and all rabbis. He was one of the first guys to get Rabban title, like great master teacher. Oh yeah, Saul got a real first-rate rabbinical education in the Hebrew scriptures, in the Pharisaical tradition. He says in Acts 22, I am a Jew born in Tarsus, in Cilicia, educated, basically he's saying here, he's talking in Jerusalem, educated here at the feet of Gamaliel according to the strict manner of the law of our fathers. That's who I am. So you tell me I'm not Jewish enough? Nonsense. I'm more Jewish than any of you. I mean, like I'm Mr. Jew, you know? I'm Captain Jew over here. I should have the yellow star emblazoned on my forehead. I mean, I'm as you can't get more Jewish than this. So I know it. I'm steeped in it. Now, so did that matter very much? How about that? Does that make any difference? Well, here is someone again who is going to be called out. I said, well, he's going to be the apostle to the Gentiles. But you know, I like someone who knows. Does that mean you have? Does he have to have all that? Did Peter have all that? Did John, James have? You don't have to know all those things. You don't have to be all that. But it just so happens that in the matrix of this guy's background and everything that made him who he was, the Lord decided, I think I'll go ahead and just plant his roots as deep as they can go in the theology. So that when he begins to write, because who, I ask you, is the premier theologian of the New Testament among all the apostles? I mean, is it even a question? You know, remember when we spent all that time reading through Hebrews, and I said, you know, there's a traditional idea that Paul wrote it, but there was a lot of reasons to think maybe he didn't. The fact is, what makes people so strongly want to think he might have is not the actual details about it. A lot of the factors point to someone else. But it's just the fact that it's so well written by somebody who really knew his stuff. And when you think of somebody like that, you just keep thinking of Paul. I think for a lot of people, it's just hard to imagine anybody else would know that much and would be that learned to be able to lay out the theology that way. So if there's going to be an apostle who is going to be the one who is going to pen so much of the important Christian theology to make sense of it, might it not be important that that person be really trained? So when you read Romans and he's talking to fellow Jews, you know what I mean, about how Christ is the fulfillment and he's quoting prophets. You see, a lot of fellow Jews at the time might have said, if Saul was just some guy that, you know, had a moderate level of training and background, they might have said to him, well, you know, you don't know what we know. You're just a simpleton. But they couldn't say that about him. When he laid out the arguments, how Jesus fulfills the prophecy, how he is the fulfillment of all of the things, everything that the old covenant pointed to be fulfilled. When he said all those things, they couldn't say, oh, he's just a simpleton. Oh, he doesn't know. Because they had to face the fact that this is a Gamaliel trained man. He went through the entire Pharisaical school and tradition. We can't say this about him. You can't berate him for that. That just was not something could be said. So, to conclude here about our man of the hour, who we're going to follow now. We're going to see everything he does. At every place he goes. Maybe one of the best things here is when you get to chapter 9. It's a good place to close in considering this background of Saul of Tarsus. Paul the Apostle. Acts chapter 9. After the conversion, you know, happens in this dramatic thing happens on the road, right? Damascus. And there was this disciple in Damascus named Ananias. Acts 9, chapter 10, verse 10, it says, when God comes to tell him what's going on, he says, the Lord said to him, talking about this Ananias, in a vision. He said, Ananias, here I am, Lord, he said. The Lord said to him, rise. And go to the street called Straight at the house of Judas. Look for a man of Tarsus named Saul. For behold, he is praying. And he has seen a vision of a man named Ananias. That's you. He's seen a vision of that man. Come in and lay hands on him that he might regain his sight. But Ananias answered, Lord, I have heard from many about this man, how much evil he has done to your saints at Jerusalem. And here, he has authority from them, from the chief priest, to bind all who call on your name. That was true. Ananias is no dummy. He's like, wait a minute. Are you sure? I know who this guy is. And you might be mistaken on this one. This is a bad dude. You don't mean for me to go to him, do you? And here's the key verse here. Verse 15. But the Lord said to him, go, for he is a chosen instrument of mine to carry my name before the Gentiles and kings of the children of Israel.